Thanks for saying that. Yeah, so I'm from Florida, as Phil said, and people always ask me why I've moved over to Northern Ireland, and I haven't come up with a good answer for that yet. I've been here for 2 years, and I'm still working on a good answer for that, but I love living here. I actually do love the weather. I love the rain. I love the cold. So this is like heaven for me. Although my wife really likes the Florida sun, and she misses it quite a bit. But anyway, enough of that. Let's talk about the Bible. Before I begin, let me say that, kind of to preface what we're going to talk about, I've been kind of dealing with the Bible and the trustworthiness of the Bible for several years now in Northern Ireland, and I've found that a lot of people struggle with an issue of separating two things, separating reason and faith. And those are two separate issues, and we shouldn't mix them. And if you have faith, you have faith in spite of evidence. When there's no evidence, you just have faith, and these kind of are two separate issues. And I found that that's kind of ingrained deep into a lot of people's heads, and I think it's wrongly ingrained in a lot of our minds that there's this big chasm between reason and faith, and you just believe when there's no evidence, when there's nothing to actually believe in, to actually see with your own eyes. You just trust and you believe, and that's what faith is. And I want to try and convince you that that's a wrong way of thinking. It's an unhelpful way of thinking, and faith and reason interact. They're bound up with one another. And God calls us to believe, he calls us to trust, but not because he hasn't given us any evidence. I mean, think about the biblical stories that are all throughout Old Testament and New Testament, like Moses. Moses says, go command Pharaoh to let my people go. And Moses says, how do I know that you're going to be with me? And God doesn't say, just believe. He gives him evidence. He says, take your staff, throw it on the ground, and it becomes a snake. Take your hand, put it in your cloak, and it comes out with leprosy. God shows him. He gives him evidence. He gives him something tangible to see, not because he doesn't need to believe, but so that he can believe. And it's the same for us. I think that we need to bring our faith and reason together, that there are good reasons to believe the Bible is reliable. And just because there's good reasons and there's evidence doesn't take away from faith. And I'm not suggesting to you that you don't need faith. You definitely do. But God calls us to believe because of the evidence, not in spite of the evidence. Now, here's the thing. God may not give us complete evidence. He may not give us everything there is to know, but he does give us sufficient evidence to trust that he is reliable and his word is reliable. So there's a ton of stuff out there. There's a vast amount of information and evidence out there that shows to us quite clearly that the Bible is reliable, that it's his word, that it's trustworthy, that it's not just fanciful dreams of illiterate peasants in the Middle Eastern world. There's lots and lots of evidence that we just don't even think about and maybe you've never heard about. So I want to just kind of survey some of the things that we can think about, some of the things that God has preserved for us and given us to see that the Bible is reliable, that it's trustworthy, that the Old and New Testaments are worthy of our attention and basing our lives on them. So I'm going to talk about just a handful of things, and I'm going to kind of hit the high points and try and cover a few different ways you can approach this topic. And I'm sure that I'm going to leave questions unanswered, and I might spark, you know, questions that you have, and we'll try and set aside some time to talk about that at the end. But one of the big problems with this topic is that if you search online for something like, can I trust the Bible, 75% of what you're going to find is going to be absolute trash, completely wrong, based on no solid research, spouted by people that think they know what they're talking about or want to basically convince you of what they're saying but have no good basis for doing so. And part of the problem is that we go online and we Google for answers to questions like this when we should be reading books. I'm a teacher. I teach at Union College where Phil is a student. And we read books. Why don't we read books anymore? It's such a waste. All these books have been written. Read them. Read them. You can read them. You can do this. And I want to show you that you can do this. Don't go online for stuff because you're going to find the wrong information. For example, if you go online and say, you know, can I trust the Bible? You're going to find a ton of people that say, Jesus never existed. What? And you're going to think, wait a minute. Hold on. Then who am I singing to and praying to and worshiping on Sunday morning? What do you mean Jesus never existed? And you'll find actually lots and lots of people online, and maybe they have videos or lectures or blogs you can read that say there's no evidence that Jesus even existed. What are you going to say in response to that? Do we have any tangible evidence to point to? Yeah, we've got a ton. We've got a ton. But unfortunately, the people that speak the loudest about this issue know the least about it. So, is there any evidence outside of the Bible that Jesus was a real historical person, or is it all just in the New Testament? There's actually a lot of information outside the Bible. Let's just talk about a couple. I'm not going to give you all of them, just a couple bits of historical information not written by Christians or believers that show us that the things that we see in the Bible correspond really, really well with what we know about ancient history. This first little bit of history comes from a guy named Tacitus, who's writing in the early 2nd century, not a Christian, not a believer, he's not Jewish, he's got no stake in the matter, and he's just writing a history. It comes from his book called the Annals, written really early in the 2nd century. And he's talking about the reign of Nero, and remember, Nero is... people think is responsible for burning a huge part of Rome, if you remember that story while he's playing his harp. So Tacitus gives us a little bit of information about what happened when Rome burns. He fastens the guilt on this group of people called Christians. He fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, you should know that name, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for a moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. And he goes on a little bit later to say that an immense multitude of people were convicted of being Christians. So we know from Roman history that Tiberius reigned around the time of Jesus. We know that Pontius Pilate was a governor in Judea from about 26 to 36 AD. And so if a guy named Christus suffered the extreme penalty in Judea at the hands of a guy named Pontius Pilate, it must have happened sometime between 26 and 36 AD. Does that fit with what we know of the Bible? Yeah, that fits pretty much exactly with what the Bible says, not in detail, but in the broad contours of what the Gospels say about Jesus. This fits really, really well. Now, here's another guy writing independently of Tacitus, also another non-Christian writing about his experience as a politician, as a governor, and he's writing to the emperor at the time, around about the same time that Tacitus is writing. This guy's name is Pliny. Pliny is writing to the emperor asking for advice. He says, dear emperor, I've got a group of Christians. They're weird. They're new, and I don't know what to do with them. And he's writing from Asia Minor. Please tell me what to do with them. And he kind of describes this group of Christians by saying that they were accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and to sing antiphonally. Do you know what antiphonally means? Anybody? Back and forth to one another. If you sang a line, and then this group said it, sang a line, and then back and forth, they would sing the Psalms that way. Amazing. I wish we would do that today, even though we don't. But here's the key. Who are they singing to? Christ as to a God. and bind themselves by an oath not to some crime, but rather not to commit theft, robbery, or adultery, not to break their trust, not to refuse to return a pledge when asked to do so. So let's recap real quick. We've just looked at two sources. There are lots more that we could look at. We could look at people like Josephus. We could look at other historical records from around the time of Jesus. What do? They show us a lot of information that corresponds pretty well with what we find in the Gospels and Acts. And we haven't even opened a Bible yet. And we know that these guys talk about a historical Christ. Now, that's really interesting. They don't call him Jesus. They call him Christ, which means Messiah. So you've got a Jewish Messiah being worshipped as a god by Gentiles, not just in Judea and Asia Minor, but all the way in Rome. And we know that this Christ led a religious movement that sparked a massive movement of people. Multitudes are becoming Christians, and they're worshiping him not as a teacher, not as a philosopher, but as a god. Does that fit kind of generally with what we see in the Gospels? It fits really, really well with what we find in the Gospels and Acts. Not just the location, but the time, the names of people involved, and the historical circumstances of who Jesus was, what he was doing, and the results of his ministry. So, if you see someone saying, you know, this Jesus guy never even existed, they're saying that with absolutely no reference to any of the historical sources outside the Bible, which clearly, clearly tell us that the Gospels give us a really accurate account in the broad contours, the broad outlines of the story we find in the Gospels and Acts and the epistles of the New Testament. They fit really, really well with what we find in other non-Christian sources from about the same time. Now, let's go a bit deeper here. So let's establish the fact that Jesus existed. Okay, great. And a lot of these things might be true. Now, why should we read the Gospels? Let's bring the Bible back into the discussion. Why should we read the Gospels and not just assume that they're fairy tales? They're just embellishments. They're traditions of people that have, you know, passed down the stories of Jesus from generation to generation, and they're full of fanciful things like miracles and walking on water and turning bread into, enough that would feed multitudes and rising from the dead. Why don't we just put these books in the same category as fairy tales and myths? Why don't we do that? And I'll take a dramatic sip of coffee to let that question sink in. Do we have any good reason to say that these books are more than fairy tales or something qualitatively different? There's a ton of evidence. There's a ton of evidence that we should not recognize these as fairy tales and myths. The kind of books that we find in the New Testament are not the kind of books that were written in antiquity about fairy tales. What do they resemble? Histories. Books that were written about history and writing about current events. Let me just give you a little flavor of this real quick. So, one of the things that people have been doing recently in scholarship is digging down and looking at the local knowledge that gospel writers have. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are our gospels. Luke also wrote his companion volume, the Book of Acts. How well do those correspond to what we know about the history, the culture, the place, the time, things like that in the first century in Judea, Samaria, and Galilee? Because it would be a big problem, right, if these gospel writers were talking about people like Peter, John, James, Jesus, and in fact, no one even had those names in the first century. I've heard this online. I spend too much time looking at bad ideas online because it fills me with rage. But have you ever heard someone say, like, you know, where would Jesus, this is a Jewish guy in Judea, Galilee in the first century, where would he ever find someone named Peter? Come on, Peter is a modern name. Right? Where would you find someone named Thomas? Come on. Those are modern names. Why am I bringing up names? Well, names are really hard to remember, aren't they? You don't have to raise your hand, but you may have already forgotten my name. Right? Now, I wouldn't hold that against you, because if you told me your name 5 minutes ago, I would have probably forgotten it as well. Names are really hard to remember, aren't they? There's no logical reason why you should have the name you have. It's arbitrary. And so when we remember stories and we pass them down over time, names fall apart and they get left behind. But the big picture stays there. But if you can actually remember someone's name and you've got the details right, you can be pretty confident that they've got the big picture right. So recently, someone has done a ton of really boring, mundane research. I'm not talking about myself, but I could be talking about myself, about what people were named in the first century, in the time of Jesus. What was the most popular name for boys in the first century if you were Jewish? And the most popular name for girls if you were born as a Jew in the first century, time of Jesus, place of Jesus. Now, let me see if anyone has a good guess. Based on all the research of all the documents that can be found, all the graves and funerary inscriptions and all the texts, non-Christian, Jewish, everything, gathering up the most common names for men and women in the first century in the place and time of Jesus, what do you think would be the most common name for men? Joseph is a really good guess. It's not the most common. John is another very good guess. It's not the most common. Both of those are in the top seven, though. Matthew's a good guess, but no, not in the top seven. Judas. Oh, really? You think more than one person could be Judas? Judas is in the top seven. Not number one, though. Peter, you're on the right track. It's not Peter, but Simon. That's, you know why that's a good idea? Yeah, he's just saying Bible names. Jonah would be a rare name in the time of Jesus. Very interestingly, not interesting at all, but now he says, I'm just saying Bible names. Now, why would that be a good idea? It's a good idea because the Gospels give us a really good idea about what people were named. Now, you have probably never thought about that. It's probably bypassed you every day of your life, the fact that when you read the Gospels and Acts, they give you a really, really good idea of what people were named in the first century. Let me show you. So, there's a massive, massive list of names. Number one on the list, Simon, same thing as Simeon. They're basically the same name, a Hebrew way to spell it and a Greek way to spell it. Now, this is not counting the Bible. This is outside the Bible. This is counting all the other historical sources we have, textual, archaeological. Simon, by far, the number one most common name for Jewish males in the time of Jesus. Guess what? Coincidence, coincidence. Guess what the most common name for men is in the Gospels and Acts? Simon. There's eight of them in the gospel. Simon Peter, Simeon in the temple, Simon the tanner, Simon the leper, Simon of Cyrene. They're all over the place. Very, very interesting, isn't it, that the number one most common name for men, Jewish men, in the Mediterranean world in the time of Jesus is also, coincidentally, the number one most common name for men in the Gospels and Acts. That's a really interesting coincidence. Number two most common name, we've already heard it, Joseph. Joseph is kind of the Greek way to spell Joseph, which is the Hebrew way to spell it, same name. Second most common name for Jewish men in the Mediterranean world, time of Jesus. Any Josephs in the Gospels and Acts? How many do you think there are? Five? Four? Well, you were really close. Six. Huh. Here's another really interesting coincidence. You know how I just said that Joseph is the second most common name for Jewish men in the time of Jesus? Guess what it is in the Gospels and Acts. Second most common name. Six of them. I'm not going to go through all of them. You got Joseph, Jesus' adoptive father. Joseph actually is one of the brothers of Jesus. In Matthew chapter 13, verse 55, we find out Jesus had brothers. One of them name is Joseph. Joseph of Arimathea. You know Barnabas, Acts chapter 4? Luke tells us that his given name is Joseph. Now, let's go through the rest of the names more quickly than that. So the top seven I've got up here, just to give you a sample of the total rank, refers to outside the Bible. Outside the Bible, not counting the Gospels and Acts, not counting the biblical witness. It's all the other sources. That is the total rank. Simeon, Joseph, Lazarus, Judas, John, Jesus. Jesus, very common name. And Ananias. Interestingly, they're all attested in the Gospels and Acts. They're all there. Really, really interesting. I did a kind of an experiment to see if this was statistically important. And I discovered that, yes, this is statistically amazing. I lived in Scotland for a few years. I did some research in Edinburgh for a few years. And when I lived there, I was convinced that every man was either named Alistair or Scott. Because in one the church we went to, there was five Alistairs. Then what I did was I checked to see what the most common names were for men in my age group in Scotland on the National Records of Scotland website, and I found that I was dead wrong. The number one name for men in my age group in Scotland at the time, I forgot, I've written it down here somewhere. I think it was David. David. I don't think I have it written down. David. I was wrong. Alistair wasn't even in the top 10. Can you believe that? My impression about what someone's name should be is going to be wrong if I'm trying to make up a story. If I'm trying to write up a fairy tale, write up a myth, and populate it with the right names and people, my impression is going to be wrong. Maybe you get one name on there. Maybe you get two names on the list. But what are the chances that you get all the right names, not just the right names, but in the right proportions? That is statistically amazing. And this is just one of the ways you can analyze the Gospels and Acts. We could do all sorts of other things. But before we move on, let's talk about the ladies. Ladies, you could probably have guessed. You could probably have guessed that on the total rank of names for ladies in the time of Jesus that were Jewish, Mary is probably going to be near the top. And indeed, it is. The statistics are amazing. Like if you were a woman in the time of Jesus, you had like a 40% chance of having the name Mary. It's just incredible how many Marys there were out there. And it comes as no surprise, then, that that's the most common name for women in the Gospels and Acts, Mary. Now, we don't have the same sort of statistical similarity with the men. Part of that is probably because there's a lot fewer women in the Gospels and Acts than there are male characters. But even still, we have a really good correspondence. And so I'm getting all this material from a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, which is totally worth looking into if you're kind of nerdy like me. And Richard Bauckham is the one who wrote it, and he says, all the evidence indicates the general authenticity of the personal names in the Gospels. These names indicate the eyewitness sources of the individual stories in which they occur. This is the sort of stuff that eyewitnesses remember. This is not the sort of stuff that people who are making up fairy tales can get right. When you make up names, you get them wrong. What's next? We could do the same thing with geography. I don't really want to spend time on it because I think you get the picture. This is a map. It's a representation of a map done in the first century. And look how wrong it is. Just orient yourself to that for a moment and try and figure out what you're looking at. It really comes as no surprise that it's wrong. We know that. Old maps are terrible. They don't have satellites. They can't really get a good image. And if you zoom in closely on Judea, which, do I have this? Oh, I actually do have that. Oh, but you can't see it on the screen. Oh, well. So you're looking at the Mediterranean. That's Italy, and then Greece, and then Palestine over on the far right. If you look at the names, they're all wrong. It's all wrong. So now you've got to make up a gospel. Let's make up a fairy tale. Make up a myth. Write a story about Jesus. It's fanciful. How do we get the geography right? You go to your local library and you check out a map and an atlas, and this is what you see. Now let's tell a story about how Jesus goes from place to place. How close are your names going to be? How close are the places going to be? What about bodies of water? What about plants and animals? They're going to be hilariously wrong. They're going to be hilariously wrong. What did the Gospels do? They get incredible details perfectly right. They know the locations of pools. They know the locations of bodies of water, of tiny little towns that you've never heard of, Bethphage, Bethany. So Charlesworth is another archaeologist who was writing in a book, Jesus and Archaeology, just little tiny little tidbits, little snapshots of the fact that for a long time people thought that the gospel writers were just making stuff up until we started to find things. The discipline of archaeology is relatively recent. It's only recently occurred to people that, hey, we can actually start digging in the dirt and finding things that are written about in the Bible. And when you do, you find tons of stuff. Tons of stuff. This is a pool of Bethesda, talked about in John's Gospel, chapter 5, which for a long time was thought to be just a fanciful symbol of something until they found it. It's in the right place at the right time with the right things that confirms to archaeologists, this is Bethesda. John describes the layout of the pool that corresponds to the layout of this pool. Here's another one, the pool of Siloam. John chapter 9 was thought for a long time to be a joke by John because we didn't know where it was. And because the name Siloam means scent, and John actually tells you that, it just sounds like a symbol of something else. It doesn't sound like a real pool. Until 2004, they were digging a pipe through the old city of Jerusalem, doing some plumbing work, and then they found, lo and behold, the pool of Siloam. They found, because it's in the right place where John describes that it is, it dates to the right time, and it's got the right stuff in it. I could go on and on and on talking about different archaeological discoveries that confirm the reliability of the Bible. Now, let me make one more comment about this, and then I'll tell you about that stern young man. One of the things that people forget about biblical archaeology, and by archaeology I mean like when people are like finding the city of Sodom or the city of Jericho or something like that, is that there's lots of stuff out there. There's lots and lots of stuff out there. And generally speaking, scholars are divided and they argue with one another, not about whether or not certain things in the Bible happened, but when and where they happened. So for example, you know the story of the Exodus of the people of God, of Israel. They're in Egypt. They're captive, and then they go out as a big group in the Exodus. They cross the Red Sea, and they go into the Promised Land. Now, among scholars, and I mean academics who are liberal, conservative, Christian, non-Christian, they don't debate whether there was an Exodus. That's not the debate. They debate when it was. So there's an early theory and a late theory. Was it in the 15th century or the 13th century? That's the question, when it occurred, not whether it occurred. And that's really the issue that it comes down to with all of the biblical archaeological things that we could talk about. Like the city of Sodom, there's a guy who thinks he's found it. And there's a lot of evidence that supports it. Really could be the city of Sodom. Now, other people say, no, I think that site, this other place, is Sodom. But you see, that's really significant, that they're debating where and which. They're not debating whether or not it happened. This fellow, Sir William Mitchell Ramsay, writes about how he wanted to follow Paul's footsteps. He wanted to retrace Paul's footsteps in the Mediterranean. The book of Acts, you get, have you read the book of Acts recently? Thinking of place names and cities and towns and bodies of water and personal names, The book of Acts is just chock full of them. And this guy was part of a really liberal scholarly movement about 100 years ago that basically assumed it was all made up. The biblical narrative was all made up, and the book of Acts is just a fanciful kind of romance story, basically. And so he wanted to prove it. So he retraced Paul's footsteps in the book of Acts. But what he found blew his mind, because what he found was that Luke's narrative of Paul's travels from town to town, from island to island, were perfect. It was totally believable. Paul's journeys. And he concludes his book talking about how he actually was converted to the Christian faith because of this experience. And he said, further study showed that the book could bear the most minute scrutiny as an authority for the facts of the Aegean world, and that it was written with such judgment, skill, art, and perception of truth as to be a model of historical statement. I set out to look for truth on the borderland where Greece and Asia meet, and found it there in the book of Acts. You may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historians, and they stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment. You can read the rest of his book. But what this basically shows us is not that every detail may be true. I do think that is right. But what all this shows us is that the Gospels are not fairy tales. They are grounded in history, and they have real people in real places doing real things. So you may not want to believe them, but you cannot set them aside as fairy tales. C.S. Lewis, you'll know the name. You may not know that he actually studied fairy tales. Like, he loved the Norse fairy tales and the sagas and the myths. And he spent his life, his academic career, studying all sorts of romances and fairy tales and sagas and things. And he says, I can tell you definitively, beyond any question at all, that the Gospels and Acts are not in that genre. They are a completely different sort of book. They're written self-consciously as history, grounded in real places. And I should have shown you that quote as I read it, but oh well. Can't turn back the clock. I had one other thing to say about, before I move on to my last question. How are we doing on time, Philip? I don't know. Okay. Minor point, and then my last big point. Okay, so minor point. We've got how many Gospels? 4. Very good. Ministry student on the ball. Okay, so we've got 4 Gospels. Let's compare that real quickly to someone like Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great, everyone believes there was an Alexander the Great, right? Do we have any doubters in the crowd that think there was no Alexander the Great? Do we have any people in the crowd that think that Alexander the Great maybe existed but didn't do any of the stuff we think he did, like conquer the entire world? Anyone? All right. Now, your skepticism might be justified, and I'll tell you why. What sources do we have from the time of Alexander the Great that give a narrative of his life? 0. Okay, that's too hard of a hoop to jump through. How many sources do we have from his generals who succeeded him? 0. None. The earliest narrative of Alexander the Great that we have comes from 200 years after he lived. So that could not have been by an eyewitness, unless it's a really, really old eyewitness. 200 years we wait. Now, there are 4 narratives of his life, and the earliest one is 200 years after he died. Okay, we've got 4 Gospels, all written within the first century, even by critical, skeptical, atheist, agnostic scholars. They agree. The 4 Gospels were written within the first century, within the same century that Jesus lived, died. That's just a brief comparison to remind you that in terms of history and what people usually have to deal with in history, Christians have it made. We've got tons of material to work with. And amazingly, the material agrees. The Gospels tell one unified story. Yeah, there's differences, but there's different emphases in all sorts of historical documents. Now, let's talk about a question. That's the name of the book, if that's interesting to you. The Bearing of Recent Discovery by William Ramsey. You know archive.org? You probably have never heard of that. Archive.org is a great website where they'll scan books that are out of copyright and put them online for free, and that's one of them. Anyway, I'm going to skip that. Now, we might have a gospel story, the book of Acts, New Testament letters, that broadly correspond to the contours of history. We might have really close eyewitness accounts in the gospels, but what keeps us from thinking that maybe the church hasn't simply just rewritten them? Have you heard that said before? The church has just kind of erased things it didn't like, rewritten what they do like, changed stories, erased kind of embarrassing things. The church has kind of, you know, written into its text things that give it power. How do we know that the Bible hasn't been completely lost, like the meaning of the Bible hasn't been lost over time? For example, you read the Old Testament. Every other passage, it seems like, speaks about Jesus in a prophetic way. You know, Genesis 3:15, Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, Psalm 2. So many texts tell us about Jesus in a prophetic way. How do we know that those haven't just been rewritten by Christians after the fact? Interesting question, right? Well, here's how we know that. The Bible you read, the Old Testament you read, is the exact same Bible that Jews today use in their synagogues. Would they for a moment read an Old Testament that's been rewritten by Christians? No, they'd say, don't give me that. I don't want that. I don't want your, you know, corrupted, Christianized Old Testament. They'd say, give me the pure Old Testament. They wouldn't call it that, but give us the Hebrew Scriptures. We use the exact same Old Testament. Our Old Testament is a translation of the original Hebrew. The original Hebrew comes from what's called the Masoretic text. The exact same text is used in Jewish synagogues today. More than that, the Dead Sea Scrolls, you've heard these mentioned, you don't know why they're important. Let me tell you why they are important. First of all, they were found in Star Wars-looking caves late 1940s, and they're still being published today, still being studied, because there's so many of them. This may not make any sense to you, but for the one person that this does make sense to you, this is all for you. So, time of Jesus, round about the first century AD, right? Well, the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text that was the base of our translation for our English Old Testament, used to come from a 10th century manuscript. So, obviously, the books were written way back, you know, in the BC era, 8th century BC, 6th century BC. But the only copy, the physical copy that had been handed down to us by the scribes that were actually passing it down, came from the 10th century AD, which is a massive, massive gap in time. What the Dead Sea Scrolls did for us was shorten that gap incredibly, incredibly, by more than a millennium. The Dead Sea Scrolls are Hebrew copies of the Old Testament and other books that date before the time of Jesus. Let that sink in for a minute. They date to the 3rd century BC, the 2nd century BC, before Jesus. These have been dated by paleography and carbon 14 analysis. Our Bible, our Old Testament, is confirmed by the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. What do the Dead Sea Scrolls do? First, they prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that no Christian has corrupted the Old Testament and made it look more like Jesus. And they show the continuity of copying, the care of transcribing the Bible over the millennia, that it's been done carefully. Yes, there are differences between the Dead Sea Scrolls that have been discovered and the text from the 10th century AD. Yeah, there are differences. But relative to the amount of text we're talking about, they are very, very minor. The sorts of differences are the kinds of things that fill footnotes in academic journals. They're not the sort of things that would require you to go buy a different updated Bible. The Bible in substantial, in its substantial components is exactly what we thought it was once we discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. So does that make sense? The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls confirmed that Christians had not corrupted the text, and they show a very careful transmission of the Old Testament text, okay, in large part. We could go into more detail about that, but I won't. I'll leave that for questions later. Here's an example of that, but sorry. Here, let's talk about the New Testament now, and we'll kind of close with this. This is a helpful way to close. So what about the New Testament? How do we know that the church hasn't embellished and changed and rewritten the New Testament text, the stories about Jesus? We're actually in a better situation with the New Testament than we are with the Old. Okay? Well, maybe it's just different, maybe not better. That is a chart made by a friend of mine giving you a bar graph of each century after the writing of the New Testament. And the height of each bar corresponds to how many handmade copies, or we call them manuscripts, we have from that century of the New Testament. Okay? So to actually translate the New Testament, here's one right here. This is my Greek New Testament. To translate this and to put this together, we're not dependent on one manuscript that's like buried in the Vatican in a vault somewhere under lock and key. No. We don't have two or three or four or five manuscripts. We have over 5,000 manuscripts spread out evenly, well, somewhat evenly, over the centuries. And you can see it really peaks in the 11th, 12th, 13th century in the medieval time. But that's not the only time you can get manuscripts. You can go back to the 9th, 8th, 7th, 6th, 5th, all the way to the 2nd century AD. We have a clear snapshot of what the text looked like in each century. Now, the important thing is that these manuscripts, these copies of the New Testament, are not hidden away under lock and key. They are scanned in high-resolution images and put online for free. So if you were nerdy like me and like Phil, you could go online and look at every single one. You could do one better. You could spend a couple years and learn Greek, which is the language they're written in, and actually read them for yourself. And so if the church decided at any point that it wanted to rewrite the Bible, you would easily be able to spot at which century it occurred by looking at the manuscripts before it and after it, all the way back to the 2nd century, when there was no church structure in Rome that you could even see and say, yeah, they're the ones that changed the Bible. We have manuscripts from Egypt, from Syria, from Asia Minor, from Italy, from Greece, from North Africa, different languages. And we're not dependent on one. We have a massive amount. Here's a little fact that you may not even have heard before. In terms of handmade copies, manuscripts of the New Testament, we have more manuscripts of the New Testament than any other book from antiquity by a mile. The next best book after the New Testament in terms of manuscript numbers is Homer's Iliad. And there's, I think, 1,700 copies. We've got over 5,000, almost 6,000 handmade copies in Greek, original Greek, of the New Testament. So you can spot how the text has changed over time, and we keep discovering more and more. We keep finding more and more manuscripts that help us confirm that the text we have has not been changed, lost in transmission. See, we usually think that the Bible is translated, and then that's lost, and then you get another one. And then the next generation translate the Bible, and they lose the ones something somehow disappears. We have this really linear understanding of how the Bible's been handed down to us, which is completely wrong in every way. What we have is a massive spider web going out from the center, where you can lose text here and there, but the substantial continuity is easy to track because we have so many manuscripts that are being discovered, and they're taking us closer and closer and closer to the original text. We're not getting further and further away. We're actually getting closer and closer because we're discovering more manuscripts, earlier manuscripts, and we're getting better at studying them and piecing them together. So I'll just put that up on the screen as we close to say this is the prologue to Luke's gospel. And one of the reasons why he says he writes it is so that his audience, this guy named Theophilus, could have certainty of the things that he had been taught. And that's an appropriate thing to want, right? You read the Bible and you want certainty that it's true. But what you can do is test it and see. You can test it and see. Does it correspond to what we know about history? Does it correspond to what we know about first century culture and life and language and people and places? It does. It does. And we have more than one witness. We've got four. Plus Paul, plus Peter, plus John. Lots of voices telling us all together that what you read about Jesus is reliable. Is it appropriate to pray as we close? Is that okay? Well, let me pray for you, and then I'll open it up to any questions that you might have. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for your word, and we thank you that your word stands forever, and we thank you for giving us so much to see and to believe, and evidence that we can recognize and come to know, that helps us to see that you are who you say you are, and you are the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you are the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Thank you for the gift of Christ, the gift of his death and resurrection. Thank you for your word, which attests to those things, and we pray in his name. Amen. If there's time for questions, what do you want to know?